This is an ABC podcast.
Max isn't your typical scientist.
So the moment when I found my first plastic in a cod, I was like, woohoo, I'm so excited.
Everything she studies.
And then I was like, oh no.
It's part of a bigger cosmos.
I found contamination in like the lifeblood of the province.
Where people don't just live on the land is their family.
How do I not cause harm by telling people that their lifeblood is contaminated?
Max is tracking where the tons of plastic we use end up in the ecosystems of Labrador and Newfoundland in Canada. That's where she lives. And on a given day, you might find Max peering inside fish guts to see what's inside. But actually, there's a whole lot more going on.
If you're dissecting a fish, you should be polite to it. You shouldn't treat it like a crappy specimen. You should treat it like a relative or at least a formerly living being if that's not part of your cosmology. We got special permission to return the animal guts to the land where we got them as a form of respect, recognizing that we sort of interrupted cycles by removing something from its environment, so we put it back. And you can see that from an Indigenous cosmology, that you return people back to the land, or you can see it from, say, an ecological perspective, that nutrient circulation is really important, so fish don't belong in incinerators.
You can already get a strong sense of why Dr. Max Libreron has called their powerful new book Pollution is Colonialism. Natasha Mitchell and Belinda Smith back with you for Science Friction.
It was a real highlight of the Melbourne lockdown recently, looking at my four walls, but getting the chance to speak with this radical and smart scientist on the other side of the world.
Can you hear me?
Yes. You can. I can, yeah.
Yes, the windy, wet, wild world of the subarctic.
Is this better? Can you hear me now? Sorry.
Max is Associate Professor in Geography and Sociology at Memorial University of Newfoundland in Canada.
One, two. That's working.
They run the Civic Laboratory for Environmental Action Research, or CLEAR. I have to say, that's a pretty handy acronym. Is it a backronym? Did you come up with CLEAR first and then try to fit
yes.
the words in there? You did.
Absolutely. I sat with an acronym generator for quite a while, plugging things in. And actually, now I'm not such a fan of the word civic, but the acronym is so good. That it's going to stay.
Great. What kind of research does CLEAR conduct?
So we have two streams of research at CLEAR. One is this plastic pollution research. We mostly do monitoring. How much plastic is in the environment? What kind? How much? Is it changing? Where might it be coming from to try and affect change? And then the second stream of research we do is anti-colonial and feminist methods in science. So we do that on plastics, but you can do it on anything.
So what does that even look like?
So how do you do good land relations and have humility and generosity and work as a collective, a true collective, not just a collection of random people? How do you do that in every step of research?
Now, you don't just arrive at doing anti-colonial science, and we're going to find out more about what that means today. For Max, this has been a process that goes back to their birth. She is a Métis. That's one of the three main Indigenous groups in Canada. And Max describes himself as a slowly reconnecting Métis because she was adopted as a child by a white couple.
Like many Indigenous groups, including in Australia and New Zealand and certainly Canada and the United States, there is a legacy of taking Indigenous children, taking them away from their families and either putting them in residential schools or forced labor or adoption or something like that.
And you may have seen the national reckoning going on right now in Canada as the remains of hundreds of Indigenous children have been found in the grounds of state boarding schools. Max was one of many Indigenous children who, right up until the 1980s, were taken from their families. Sometimes they were literally scooped up from the street and driven away.
In Canada, that's called the 60s scoop. I am a legacy of part of that. I was raised by two white parents who adopted like so many Indigenous kids.
But Max's cultural ties weren't completely severed.
And my parents also moved to Indigenous land that had a lot of Indigenous people in it, lots of Cree and Métis folks. And so me and my siblings grew up knowing different things or nothing about maybe our original families, but knowing a lot about Indigenous cultures and groups and language, because we would take, you know, Indigenous language classes in our school and that sort of stuff. And so in university, I sought out Indigenous groups again, because that's how I grew up.
And then Max really lent in more deeply.
I sort of started orbiting these relations that eventually claimed me. And that's a really important thing about Indigenous relations. The thing about indigeneity is that the community claims you. You don't claim the community. Claiming that something belongs to you, like indigeneity, is a very settler and colonial move. Being claimed by and being beholden to the relationships, that's more the indigenous way. So if you think about family, people are like, oh yeah, indigenous family, that's great. No, just think about having an ever-expanding family. That means you have a greater chance of having a crappy uncle. That means like more people are asking you for money. It means your couch is occupied more often by people you maybe don't like very much, right? So all those ties, as well as positive ones, come into this sort of indigenous relationality.
And this way of thinking about relationships, it extends to everything. Even the plastics we use and pollute the world with.
Yeah, plastics are kin too, even though they're often in bad relations. Métis people, which is where I come from, have a very strong tradition of making kinship ties with people who are not blood relations and things who are not blood relations. And so having those ties call me in over and over again in different ways has taken years and is probably going to happen for the rest of my life.
As a grad student, Max was drawn to gnarly problems. The gnarlier, the better.
So when I was in New York City doing my graduate work, I was initially working on what I called impossible problems. So problems around waste that seemed completely insurmountable and then somehow were surmounted. So the conditions that made it impossible had to change. And I wanted to research that because of all the environmental problems we have that seem really insurmountable right now.
Max was studying 1880s New York City when the city was the dirtiest city in the world. We're talking streets knee deep in rubbish and filth. It was bad.
And someone said, well, what about marine plastics? Are you going to study those? Those seem impossible. And I said, no, those actually are impossible to solve. And then I thought about it for a little while and basically changed my career trajectory to work just on what then was called marine plastics. And now we know they're everywhere. So just plastic pollution.
Something was starting to brew inside Max, a way to mesh their indigenous identity with their science.
For about nearly a decade, I thought I was working on just pollution problems, right? Wayward molecules, things that were in the wrong spot. But the more I brought different parts of my life together, different teachings from elders, as well as academia and science, I started to realize that pollution, including plastic pollution, was really better described as a problem of colonialism than like plastics in the wrong spot. This idea that land is a place where you can store waste, where waste belongs, so it can be mitigated or stored or assimilated. And that is a really bad land relation that's characteristic of colonialism. So that shift happened maybe about 5 years ago.
In your book, you often write about land with a capital L. What's the difference between small L land and big L land?
They actually mean very different things, even if there's overlap. So when Indigenous folks say land, usually, it depends on the cosmology, but usually we mean dirt and bees and trees, but we also mean water and stars and kin and feelings and events and spirit and ancestors, past and future, you know, all the things we can't see but know are there and the relationships between them. That's land. When lots of non-Indigenous people say land, they mean landscape, bees and trees and bees. When we're using the same term, it just differentiates that we're talking about quite literally different things.
In 2014, Max took up a new job in the province of Newfoundland and Labrador in the far east of Canada.
Newfoundland and Labrador is two parts, the island of Newfoundland and then Labrador. Labrador is subarctic and it's attached to the mainland of Canada and it is cold and icy and beautiful. And it's called the Big Land because it's got giant skies and lots of flies. and the island of Newfoundland is nicknamed the Rock because it is a giant piece of bedrock poked up above the ocean, surrounded by very cold winds in the Labrador Straits. Everything is rocky and black and shiny. It is wet.
It's a place so different to where she'd grown up in the middle of Canada, far away from any coastline. But that meant forming a whole new set of relationships too, with people, but also with the land.
You also write that in Newfoundland and Labrador, the land is loud. What do you mean by that and how have you experienced it?
Yeah, so the island of Newfoundland is a rock in the middle of the North Atlantic. The weather is really extreme. So it never gets super, super cold or super, super hot, but it can go from like flooding to sunshine to total fog in like 18 minutes. So you can't plan. You know, like, I'm going to go outside today without a coat. You can't say that. That is hubris. Or I'm going to walk down the street standing up. It's one of the windiest cities in the world. So the land is loud because it's constantly calling you back into relations. You can't ignore it. It's very hard to build things here and make them last. The roads are constantly deteriorating. My internet is wavering right now because it just started raining. That's what I mean by the land is loud. I had to once crawl on the sidewalk home from work because it was so windy that if I stood up, I'd get blown into traffic. And also some of the traffic had to stay still until they stopped rocking, right? So you can't ignore it or you will die. That's pretty loud.
And its history is loud with the grief of colonization too. The province is home to many Indigenous groups, but not all are still around.
This part of the island where I live in St. John's, which is where the capital city is the site of one of the only quote-unquote successful genocides in the world, really. The Beothuk used to live here. We don't even know how to pronounce the name because the last Beothuk who had cultural connections died before the 1900s, was killed before the 1900s.
This colonial history is threaded through the history of science too. Western science has long been used to cast Indigenous people as inferior to whites, to dispossess them of their land and children, and to dominate nature. Max does science differently, radically differently, and as part of an emerging global movement of so-called anti-colonial science. But what does that mean? Well, it starts with consent and consultation.
We just don't go onto land and do studies. We need to be invited by the Indigenous group whose land that is. I wait until they invite me on their own terms. And that has taken many years. But the relationships that result from that are so strong that our research was not impacted by the COVID epidemic because people on the land were getting the samples for us. I didn't have to go up to Nunatsiavut to get my samples. Locals were getting them because they knew what to do and we had a strong relationship. And our research has just thundered on despite the pandemic. And that is because of good relations.
Max and their crew at CLEAR, the Civic Laboratory for Environmental Action Research, they're monitoring the levels of plastic in fish, seals, sediments, water, everything that feeds into the food webs of local communities. Even micro-sized pieces of plastic and the chemicals that leach out of them are a problem. They could be doing harm not just to the animals that eat them, but also the animals that eat those animals, like humans. It's an active area of research right now. But Max and team first want to understand where plastics are turning up.
So guts is the technical term that includes the stomach, the intestine, the poop hole, all of that stuff. Yeah, we look in all sorts of animals that people eat for food, essentially. We look in them for plastics. We also look in water and sediment and snow and ice and shorelines. We look there for plastic too. But because this is a province with some of the highest wild food consumption in Canada, we pay a lot of attention to the plastics in human food webs and especially Indigenous food webs. So that's a lot of fish.
You describe a couple of really important processes that students and researchers must do or not do when they're processing fish guts, basically. Can you just walk me through those, please?
If you think at every moment of your science, how can I be in better land relations? How can I do this with more humility, recognizing my connections and that I am not greater than any of those connections? So for us, for instance, we don't wear earbuds when we work with fish. So if you were working with your aunt, alive or dead, you would not wear earbuds. You wouldn't put her in the trash when you were done. You wouldn't take disparaging photos with her. You would, right? So it's those sorts of things that we do at every level.
This is part of the anti-colonial science ethos that Max was talking about earlier. And it extends to what they do with the animal guts after they've analysed them too.
So one of the acute limits that we have in the lab is that we do not use KOH, potassium hydroxide. Potassium hydroxide is this really intense chemical that dissolves exoskeletons of things like crabs and shrimp and bones and stuff like that. So you can look at certain things for plastic. So you can't really get to the belly of a crab without dissolving it in KOH. But dissolving your relative into a slime using extreme chemicals that then result in toxic waste is really counter to good land relations. And so we don't use it. And that means that we cannot study crustaceans or mussels or bivalves, anything with an exterior skeleton or shell. And that also means we can't tell communities about plastics in some of their food. And that is a limit. At the same time, it's not like we have a shortage of samples. There are so many other things people eat. There's other studies that can show us that bivalves like mussels and clams and stuff do actually consume a lot of plastics. It's a limitation, but it's not a problem. And it ends up being a net good.
Now, The lab Max's set up describes itself as doing anti-colonial feminist science, and they say this means they're guided by principles like equity, solidarity, humility, supportive openness, and consensus-based decision-making. And this gem, if you're sick, heartbroken, or exhausted, go home. Work is not more important than your health. When Max first found tiny bits of plastic in Atlantic cod, it was a big deal because cod are part of the lifeblood of the whole province.
I quickly came to understand that I couldn't possibly know. As a newcomer to the province, as someone who wasn't from here, I really had to get the expertise of locals to tell me how to interpret and communicate this finding. And so I called my first community meeting, which then became this method called community peer review, where before I publish it anywhere, before it circulates in academia, I bring the findings to the communities where I got the fish from and that are impacted by the results. And I say, hey, this is what I found. Help me interpret this. Tell me whether I should publish it or whether this knowledge just stay in the community. Because there are lots of examples where publishing contamination results has resulted in the ostracization and harm to the communities it impacts. So in Canada, for instance, in the Hudson Bay,
this example of Hudson Bay is important. High concentrations of PCBs, or polychlorinated biphenyls, have been found in marine life here. PCBs are chemicals that were widely used to make lubricants, coolants, plastic paints and inks, but in the 1960s they were found to be toxic and are now considered to probably cause cancer in humans. PCB production stopped in the 70s, but they've lingered in soil, sediment and snow, and accumulate in organisms like fish and seals and us. And in fact, PCBs are also part of the torrid history that saw babies taken from Inuit parents near Hudson Bay.
There's very, very high PCB in actually the entire circumpolar north, but when they find high PCBs in breast milk there, that was leaked to the media before the communities, the mostly Cree and Inuit communities there, and they were ostracized. They had their children taken away for breastfeeding them. And even though a few years later, the medical profession said, actually, it's still better to breastfeed with high PCBs than to not breastfeed. Like, the damage was done. Those kids were in social services. They were considered a filthy place. It was brutal. And some of the trauma is still ongoing there. And I know that history. Those are the stakes of community peer review.
So for Max, an anti-colonial approach to science recognises this past and works to avoid repeating it.
A crucial part of community peer review is the community's right to refuse our research. It's not consent unless someone can actually refuse it, right? And consent and permission is a key part of anti-colonial land relations, right? Not being entitled to other people's land and lives and culture and food and knowledge. And so communities do have the capacity to say, no, this is ours. This is our knowledge. These are our findings. You don't publish this.
But understandably, scientists can often get caught up in a professional culture that demands a particular way of doing things and where promotion and tenured positions hinge on pumping out the publications. Max, though, is challenging that.
My publication record, my promotion, my tenure, it's called in universities, is not more important than a community's right to self-determination and being healthy and well. So that's another limitation that is also inherently good that comes out of an anti-colonial ethic.
How often do these communities say, oh no, let's not publish this either in part or in full? Does it happen often?
I don't know if I could tell you if it did happen very often, but usually it doesn't. And I can say that usually refusal is not wholesale. It's usually in parts where they're like, no, next time don't look over there, look over here, or oop, that interpretation isn't correct because you're forgetting this information. So it's a lot more like how peer review very often goes in academia. You might get your paper rejected wholesale, and yes, that happens. But more often, the peer reviewers are about like, ooh, you interpret that a little bit weird. You forgot this, it makes the piece stronger.
And ultimately, the lab's work is guided by these meetings.
People ask us questions at those meetings that I do not know the answer to, like, what about mackerel? What about freshwater? Have you tried seals? Does it matter if the animal poops fast like a fish or poops slow like a bird? Right? Because the plastics are leaching chemicals while they're inside of them. And I didn't know the answers to that. And so our research questions as a lab have come from those community meetings. And all I work on are community questions. Again, there's no scarcity of problems to work on. And that's been really fulfilling because when I do the next community meeting, it is full because they've been waiting for me to tell them things that I said last time I would check out. And that's very gratifying.
Fish, birds, turtles, Sea creatures eat plastic thinking it's food. And those awful photos of wildlife entangled in plastic bags point to the scale of the problem. We don't know exactly how much plastic is in the ocean, but a recent estimate published in the journal Science reckons we add something like 5 to 13 million tonnes every year. But Max and collaborators are also learning about where plastic isn't found. And that's had surprising consequences, including hate mail.
So at one of our community meetings, this young person said, "Hey, is there plastic in sushi?" I said, "I don't know." And so it turns out that a major component of fake crab is not crab, but a fish called silver hake. And silver hake is a fish that is usually sort of in the New England area in the United States on the East Coast, but it's coming north because of climate change and warming water temperatures north. And so I had this opportunity to study silver hake for plastics, aka sushi, and my research assistant in the lab came to me and said, "We found no plastics." And I said, "Well, that doesn't seem right. Oh no, something went horribly wrong." And we checked and double checked the methods. I got silver hake and did them myself. And no matter which way we cut it, there were no plastics in silver hake. And so then we thought, well, this is an anomaly. This is like a miracle fish. This never happens.
This astounded them.
And we did all this research of published literature. And very often in the published literature on plastic ingestion in fish, what happens is a scientist will look at a whole bunch of different species in an area, so like salmon and mackerel and trout, and then give the average of all of their ingestion rates. And what happens when you give the average is it misses the zeros. They get averaged out. And when we went deep into these studies and what's called disaggregated the species, like just sorted all the species out so they're in their own little piles, it turned out that almost half of all fish species don't in fact eat plastics. And we're like, oh, this isn't a miracle fish. This is just another Tuesday fish. How come no one reports on this? And the reason is that there's a bias in scientific publishing about publishing what's called null results, like publishing a zero.
This was exciting. They'd started with a question posed by a young member of the community, and the outcome was a whole new realm of scientific investigation.
So they don't eat plastics, or do they just poop them out really well?
So that is an area of new study, but we do know that, say, certain plankton can differentiate between plastics and non-plastics and will not eat plastics. So rotifer plankton is a plankton that I work with, and they choose not to eat plastics. We know that sea anemones will not eat plastics if someone else has eaten that plastic, so they don't eat pre-pooped plastics. And we also know that some animals that don't eat plastics, when they're really, really, really hungry, will eat plastics. So there's sort of a rainbow of ingestion habits.
Max says the stunning finding doesn't diminish the problem of plastic in marine environments. It just suggests that scientists need to focus their attention on some species and not so much on others. But that finding got some people really riled, including those you might think are Max's allies.
And when I put it on social media, I ended up getting a lot of hate mail about how I was like a shill for the plastic industry. I was like, oh no. Publishing null results are so that we can do justice better, not to accomplish an injustice. Okay, so then I wrote a couple of public audience pieces about why it's important to publish these null results. And then I stopped getting, well, that's not true. I get hate mail on other things, but not on that result anymore.
For Max, the challenge against colonialism doesn't end with the ocean or pollution or fish guts.
Colonialism in science or colonialism in general isn't just about making property. It isn't just about jerks being jerks. It's actually a land relation that is implicit in so many everyday things, from like where our garbage goes to how you do science. So it's very insidious and it's very tricky. And so I would urge people to really think about colonialism as being access to indigenous land and life worlds, even for good things like environmentalism. So my main example is a beach cleanup. If you do a beach cleanup without permission from indigenous groups, that's still colonialism. It's still entitlement to indigenous land. So that's really important to put the brakes on and think about.
In Newfoundland, is this where you see yourself being for the foreseeable future? What are your plans?
Oh, my plans. So for a long time, I thought I was going to leave. There aren't a lot of, well, there are very few other Métis folks here. But over time, especially as climate change is ripping the world apart, this is a very good place to hang out for the future. And I do have land relations here now after working on the water and working with people and making kinship and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I'm planning on probably living the rest of my life here and really settling in. And that's part of land relations. Like, once you start working with land, it gets really hard to leave. It gets really rude to leave. And starting over takes forever. It took me 6 years to get invited to Labrador. Well, if I was starting over somewhere else, it would take that same amount of time to get invited, right? So here's where I am. If you want to visit me, it's really hard to get here, but I have a couch.
I'm so taking up the offer of that couch. I am on the first flight out of here. Well, you know, when we've all been vaccinated, at least. What a powerful rethink of what science can be, what science should be.
And a huge thanks to Dr. Max Liboron from Memorial University. Max's new book is Pollution is Colonialism, and you can catch us on Twitter at Science Belinda.
And I'm Natasha Mitchell. You can also email us from the Science Friction website. We'd really love to hear from you. We'll catch you next week. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.